Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street investors were in a buying mood today, but help me out here. Irrational exuberance doesn't seem to apply. Maybe what we need today is a new term to describe a 215-point rise in the Dow. Even on a day, there were plenty of decidedly non-exuberant signals. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics. Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. And what kind of mood do you find yourself in on this Tuesday, the 27th of November? Wall Street investors were happy about some relief in oil prices and word of bailout help for Citigroup. But how deeply satisfied can they be when there's word that all the bad news lately does seem to be stirring up some perfectly rational consumer and investor gloom? Marketplace's Steve Tripoli is here with a list of what's got everyone feeling so grumpy and reasons why all that fretting may or may not signal tougher times ahead.
Yikes, what a list. Out today, the worst consumer confidence numbers in 2 years and the worst year-on-year drop in home prices in some time, plus a report predicting the foreclosure crisis is far from over. I asked the conference board's Lynn Franco about those low consumer confidence numbers from her group, where the numbers like these tend to predict recessions historically.
Yes, they do. And current readings could be shock-induced or they could be signaling a recession.
Franco and economist Diane Swank at Mesirow Financial both say the housing crunch plus rising oil prices are the biggest shocks. But Swank says that's not all.
The sense is that income inequalities have worsened, and that's a reality, frankly. It really is evident when you see luxury retailers out there reporting accelerating sales into the holiday season, even as consumers are complaining that they're feeling pinched at the pump.
Pinched consumers, volatile markets, housing and credit shocks, economists are putting them all together and earning their dismal scientist nickname, Diane Swank.
Well, I think clearly the risks of recession have gone up.
But like other economists, she still doesn't think that means a recession will happen. How come? Because consumers say they're pinched, but then tell the conference board they'll be spending more this Christmas. And OPEC is promising moves that could tame oil prices. But not everyone's convinced we'll dodge this bullet. Merrill Lynch analysts predicted a recession in a research note published yesterday, which means decent holiday spending could prove to be our final fling. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
We have told you ad nauseum now about how the subprime mortgage crisis has been and still is rocking Wall Street and financial markets all around the world. But the losses hit even harder at home, in the communities where foreclosures occur. The U.S. Conference of Mayors put out a detailed report today forecasting just how badly cities will be affected by the housing slump. And here's another one of those stomach-turning numbers. All told, the loss in economic output for more than 300 cities will equal $166 billion. Jerry Abramson is the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky. Right now, he's in Detroit, where he's huddling with fellow city leaders who've gathered there from around the country. Hi, Mayor Abramson.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Tell me, what toll has the subprime mortgage crisis taken on your community already?
Well, in my community, as an example, last year we had a little over 2,000 foreclosures in Louisville. We're a city of 700,000 people. We've already had over 3,500 as of last week.
What does that look like in cities across the country?
Unfortunately, for the last 20, 30 years, mayors have been beating on the drum in Washington and in our state capitals, focusing on inner city difficulties where you have major disinvested neighborhoods and foreclosures have occurred for those who live in those disinvested neighborhoods. What's happened this time is this now affecting the middle class.
And we're going to see a lot of neighborhoods that aren't used to having a lot of vacant homes have
Those are the calls that mayors are getting across the United States. What the mayors are most concerned about is what happens to those homes when the foreclosure begins and ultimately ends, meaning that the home is left, quite often it's vacant, the weeds grow, the grass grows, the windows get broken. We have to go in, clean up the property, end up putting a lien on it, and generally fall behind the bank with the foreclosure. And the bottom line is we get nothing. Taxpayers cover the expense.
This report paints a pretty dim picture of economic loss for a lot of cities. If the economic loss is so great, I wonder what the likelihood is that it's going to hurt your credit ratings.
Well, there was concern raised by at least two of the mayors about that issue. As the decrease in value occurs around homes that are being foreclosed on and left vacant or boarded, all of a sudden the property tax decreases. We've got to put more money into going in and policing the area. We've got to put more money into going in and keeping them boarded up and as safe as can be possible. And while we're trying to find the people that own the paper, that's the interesting thing. It's not the local banks that we're focusing on. We're trying to find the individual who ultimately sold that mortgage to or packaged it, and now it's at Countrywide or it's at Wells Fargo or it's Deutsche Bank or U.S. National Bank, none of which have locations in most of our cities. And they're the ones we're trying to connect with to ensure that we try to keep up the house so that it keeps up the neighborhood, doesn't have a negative effect on the surrounding area.
The headline on one of the stories I was reading this morning said that you're all meeting in Detroit to figure out how to blunt the impact of this foreclosure crisis. Have you come up with any ideas, and is there really much you can do when the experts say basically this is a runaway train, it's already on a crash course?
Well, the one thing that came very clear to us was that the individuals that didn't show up, that were not around the table, the realtors were here, the mortgage bankers were here, the bankers were here, the servicers were here, the nonprofit companies were here, but the group that was not here, is not here, is Wall Street. We'd like to see the Wall Street syndicators who made enormous amounts of money off these exotic packagings that they've developed work with their servicing organizations like the Wells Fargos and the Countrywides to give them the flexibility necessary to work with American citizens to get through this crisis by, if having to, leave the interest where it is, put the extra dollars on the back of the loan, and allow the folks to continue to live in the property, maintain the property, and keep the neighborhood stable.
Jerry Abramson is the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky. Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us. We wish you the best in finding some answers.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much.
Well, the Wall Streeters were on Wall Street today, giving the dice another roll on financial stocks. More on that coming right up, along with even more specifics when we do the numbers. One of the rays of sunshine that helped warm things up on Wall Street today was word of a $7.5 billion lifeline for Citigroup. The sovereign investment fund of Abu Dhabi, a country rich with oil money, is giving America's biggest bank some much-needed capital to offset its big mortgage losses. The investment will make the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority the biggest single shareholder in Citigroup, but it will not have the authority to name any board members. For some insight into how significant this news is, we turn to David Whiten, U.S. Banking Editor for the Financial Times. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I saw a Reuters report today that says analysts think this may signal that the free fall in the U.S. financial stocks is close to ending. On the other hand, a Bank of America analyst issued a report today saying he thinks that this buys Citigroup some time, but he said capital infusions don't solve problems overnight. To be blunt about it, is this going to be enough to save Citigroup from this crisis?
Well, it's enough to get their balance sheet back to where they would like it to be. And it will be enough unless we see significant further write-downs in their holdings of mortgage-backed securities. And the big question, of course, is what happens to the U.S. economy next year. If the U.S. economy goes into recession, then all bets are off.
Well, speaking of taking things onto your balance sheet, was this a desperate move by Citigroup to seal this deal? It's paying a very high price for this lifeline. Initially, these securities pay a mandatory interest rate fixed at 11%. One of our editors here compared that to trying to bail yourself out by charging your mortgage payment to a high-rate credit card. Is it something like that?
It does look very expensive, but their stock is very depressed, and they're paying a very heavy dividend on those shares. So it is very expensive, but they think it's better than cutting the dividend or by selling businesses that they think are strategically important to the company going forward.
Well, Citigroup shares have lost around 45% of their value since the start of the year. That has wiped away around $120 billion in market value, market capitalization. Is Citigroup starting to get itself bailed out here, or how much of a risk is there that it could keep sinking?
It looks very, the stock looks very cheap at this level, and it's very striking that the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority were prepared to put in $7.5 billion, which is a tidy sum even for them, into a company which is currently doesn't have a permanent chief executive.
With Middle Eastern countries building up so much financial might, are we going to see this play out for other big banks that are in trouble and might be a good value for this kind of investment right now?
We do think there could well be other Western financial institutions who need to shore up their balance sheet after the effects of the subprime mortgage meltdown in the US, companies like UBS who might look to do similar deals. And we know there is great interest among the state-owned investment companies in the Middle East and in Asia in US financial stocks, which they think are better value than domestic U.S. investors.
If that begins to happen, do you see the chance of eyebrows being raised politically?
The move by the Abu Dhabi has been welcomed by several mainstream U.S. politicians, but certainly Citigroup is wary, and so are the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, about any larger stake than 5%. So the political sensitivities are important here.
David Whiten is U.S. Banking Editor for the Financial Times. Thanks for your insights.
Thanks a lot.
We're about to reach back into the vault for a story you may have missed, way back to November 27th, 1967. 40 years ago today, this song, Judy in Disguise, was a hit tune. O.J. Simpson was being touted as the country's next big sports star. McDonald's was just starting to test market the Big Mac. And Burger King was suing Burger King. Hold on, stop the music. Jeremy Hobson is about to explain in this look back at the Burger King proprietors who wanted to, you might say, have it their way.
Judy in the Sky.
Take Interstate 57 a couple hours south from Chicago, and all of a sudden, you'll reach a 40-mile stretch without a single Burger King. Not one. The reason is right in the center of Mattoon, population 18,000. It's a little mom-and-pop shop called Burger King, but it's not owned by the Burger King Corporation, and it's been here for 50 years.
Cheese, a small fry!
Gene and Betty Hoots own the place. It started out as an ice cream store called Frigid Queen. When they expanded into the building next door in the mid-50s and started selling burgers, they came up with the name Burger King. Gene, who is now 80, recalls how the name was chosen.
Frigid Queen, that's what the ice cream place is called. Why don't you call it the Hot King? I said, no, I don't think that would go over in Mattoon. But Betty says, how about Frigid Queen says cold? How about Burger King says hamburgers?
So they told their attorney to call the place Burger King. And here's where they made their mistake. The attorney only registered the name in Illinois. So in the early 60s, some Florida businessmen snapped up the federal trademark, christening their growing chain of restaurants Burger King, home of the Whopper. When a Burger King opened in suburban Chicago, Gene Hoots heard about it and sued. He ended up in federal court 40 years ago today.
We got there about 20 minutes early with our new attorney who had just come to town. And at 1:01, the back door of the courthouse opened up. And here walks this guy in with, at that time, probably a $500 suit. Behind him were six attorneys filing, and we were impressed.
So was the judge. He let Burger King Corporation keep the name. But Gene and Betty Hoots got something. The judge ruled that the Burger King Corporation couldn't put a restaurant within 20 miles of the Hoots' Burger King. A compromise more common than you might think, says Michael Frumkin, a University of Miami law professor. He says a fundamental principle of trademark law is fairness.
We're trying to be fair to the little guy who went first, and we're trying to be fair to the big guy who went second and built something big and did the paperwork, which the little guy didn't do.
Frumkin says Gene Hoots should have objected immediately when the Florida Corporation got the federal trademark for Burger King, but...
How many people with small businesses are scanning the list of trademarks every week or every month?
Burger King Corporation declined to comment for this story, but I was able to speak to one of the lawyers who represented the Burger King Corporation back in 67. And you may be surprised to hear that Clyde Meacham didn't really remember the case.
My God, I'm 88 years old. I can't remember anything beyond last week.
When I told him about the case, he had this to say.
Why put the little guy out of business? He's not going to be any competition, you know.
Wonder what would have happened if he had said that 40 years ago.
Tim Dogs!
Meanwhile, back in Mattoon, I had to ask about one more thing. Gene and Betty's famous cheeseburger, the Hooter Burger.
Yes, the Hooter. My name is Hoots, so they called me Hooter. I think Betty came up with the idea, why don't you call it Hooter?
Now, but you know there's a restaurant called Hooters. I mean, you guys are a trademark disaster area.
Yeah, that's right.
So far, Gene and Betty Hoots haven't heard anything from Hooters lawyers. In Mattoon, Illinois, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We have photos of Gene and Betty Hoots and their burger stand on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, speeding up Italy's Lento pace with some new technology.
Of course, you have some basic information, when my bus will arrive. But you can also have some deep information, how many people are in the bus, for example.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks bounce back today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shot up 1.7%, or 215 points, to close at 12,958. The Nasdaq climbed more than 1.5%, or 39 points, to close at 2580. The S&P 500 picked up 1.5%, or 21 points, to end the day at 1428. Retailers had a good day. Office supplier Staples filed more than a 10.5% gain. Strong sales over the weekend of Guitar Hero 3. Rock video game maker Activision up more than 13.5%. And tech stocks performed well. Shares of chip giant Intel spiked up 3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders, and the National Association of Realtors releases numbers on sales of existing homes for October. President Bush holds meetings with Palestinian Authority President Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Olmert at the White House. And the Daily Show host has a birthday. Comedian Jon Stewart will be 45. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. If you're interested in the latest company getting into the renewable energy business, try Google. No need to search for it. The company we're talking about is Google. Today, the web giant announced plans to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in green energy projects. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Google plans to produce enough electricity from renewable energy sources to power a city the size of San Francisco, and to do it at a cost cheaper than coal. The company is hiring scores of engineers to research non-polluting energy sources. It says it will initially focus on solar thermal mirrors that use the sun's heat to drive electricity-generating turbines. Google's philanthropic arm will invest tens of millions of dollars in seed money for the project next year. But Yale Green Business expert Daniel Estee says Google's ultimate goal is more than altruistic. It's about profits.
This is a example of a new kind of philanthropy and a new kind of sort of company investing off the side of its core business, but in a way that might deliver big returns.
Estee says Google's Achilles heel is the massive amount of electricity required to power its servers. And as global warming casts coal's future in an uncertain light, Estee says Google is hedging its bets. And he says they have the cash to back it up. But some are more skeptical.
This is really solid image work.
Technology analyst Rob Enderle says Google's successes are creating enemies as its size and power rivals even Microsoft's.
I think they realize that if they don't step out and become aggressive on something that people care about in a positive fashion, that they're likely to be painted with that same kind of broad negative brush.
The challenge, Enderle says, is for Google not to overstep its expertise in the process. He says ultimately, Google is a web services company, not an energy giant. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Speaking of green marketing, wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have to trash your phone whenever you switch cellular providers? It has become a classic dilemma for consumers. You like the cell phone, but you don't like the network it's tied to. Well, can you hear me now? Verizon Wireless says it's going to give customers a choice. It plans to open up access to its network in 2008, and it's bound to have company. Janet Babin reports from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
What open access means is that Verizon customers will be able to buy whatever compatible phone or software they want, even if it's not made by Verizon. Analyst Linda Barraby with Yankee Group says the new applications we'll be using on Verizon's open network might not even exist yet.
Whether it's a gaming device, whether it's an iPhone-like device or an iPod-like device, it might be something that you tie to your shoe.
Daniel Berninger with wireless communications company FWD says Verizon's move is a counter to Google's recently announced open handset project. Berninger says Verizon needed a new model because the old walled garden approach, where the carrier provides music, games, videos, and news, wasn't working.
They're not putting iTunes out of business with their music offering. You know, they're probably at maybe 1% or 2% market penetration. You know, the same goes for gaming and video.
Verizon may be positioning itself to bid on new airwaves. Charles Golvin with Forrester Research says the upcoming federal auction requires companies to be open access.
And I think part of what Verizon has done is to put the foundation in place to be able to meet those requirements.
Verizon open access will be available by the end of 2008. Other companies like Sprint and T-Mobile could be next. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Few cities in the world are as haltingly beautiful as Rome. Halting, as in tourists, brought to a standstill every few feet by another breathtaking sight, traffic that inches along, and seemingly endless lines. In this case, even the Romans would prefer not to do as the Romans do, which explains why a small team of scientists from MIT is using Rome as an urban laboratory. Megan Williams reports on the new technology of getting from here to there.
They're developing a new mapping system that creates and relays up to the second information about everything that slows you down, whether you're on foot, on a bus, or in a car. I meet up with Carlo Ratti, an MIT real-time map designer near the Spanish Steps. The area is packed with tourists.
You know, the idea is how really to get information about the city and give it back to the citizens, so to everybody, to the Romans, to the tourists, and in the end, help make the city work in a better way.
The mapping technology tracks concentrations of cell phone and GPS signals. Then it shows colored lights on a map representing crowds and traffic jams, the city in motion. The goal is to have the live, constantly changing maps available at bus and subway stations, over the internet, and even on cell phones, not just to avoid crowds, but to suss out hot spots.
So say you and I are going for a walk one night. We want to get to a happening bar. We want to avoid the crowds up ahead at Piazza di Spagna. So just what would you do? I mean, what does it look like using this technology?
Say you get it from your cell phone.
Yeah.
So then that night we'll just be looking at the cell phone, look at, say, the most crowded place for going and getting an aperitivo, and we'll see it here on the map, and then we will also see the fastest way to reach it.
The technology could cut back on wasted time, time that could be used working or shopping. It could also bring huge energy savings.
And in red, it shows again the cell phone activity.
Christian Klöckel works with Ratti at MIT. Up on his computer screen is a live map of Rome they made of a recent all-night citywide festival. Pulsating dots of yellow show crowds on foot. Streaks of orange are buses edging down avenues. Klöckel says the information can help city planners make public transport a lot more efficient and cost-effective.
One is to use it for planning purposes, planning new urban mobility routes around the dynamic of people flow within the city. The other consideration is making use of this in a more flexible way of considering bus routes that can actually follow the flow of people.
And that's good news for Paolo Zocchi from Italy's Ministry of Regional Affairs. He wants to use the live map to help make Rome's clogged and clunky public transit system smooth.
Of course, you have some basic information, when my bus will arrive. But you can also have some deep information, how many people are in the bus, for example, and if the bus is with air conditioning or not, or how much time I employ to arrive from one point to another in the city.
Zocchi says with its urban crowding and chronic traffic jams, Rome needs this kind of help. The technology's almost there, he says, but it's also getting people to respond to it.
I think that the Italian government is convinced to invest. I think that the big issue is to convince also the citizen and to inform the citizen can have a very high added value for his life.
In the meantime, Lisbon, Copenhagen, and even the Scottish Highlands have come on board to develop their own maps. As for when exactly the new systems will be just a click away, well, Rome wasn't built in a day. In Rome, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, the United Nations Oil for Food Program allowed the Iraqi government to sell oil to buy food and medicine for its country's people. It was designed to offset sanctions, but somewhere along the way it became corrupt and a few people got caught with dirty hands. One of them was Texas oil man Oscar Wyatt. Well, today, the 83-year-old American was sentenced to 1 year in prison for approving illegal payments to Iraqi officials. The bottom line, divide 365 days then by $200,000 in payments. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 215 points, 1.7%. The Nasdaq moved ahead 39 points, more than 1.5%. The S&P 500 bumped up 21 points, 1.5%. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on the program, Chinese children indulge in some familiar temptations.
Coca-Cola, 7-Up, Pringles, potato chips, Frito-Lay snacks, and these kind of sort of processed foods.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.